each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome everyone. Welcome to Wednesday with Father Tom Coyce. I hope to wrinkle your brain a little bit, as I try to do each week. Today, I'm recording this on October 4th, which happens to be the feast of St. Francis of Assisi, one of the most beloved saints, the guy who's next in line for having the most statues in your gardens. Obviously, Blessed Mother holds the top rank on that regard, but many people will have a statue of St. Francis in their garden, as we do here at beautiful St. James. Anyways, I want to get to one of my favorite stories, one of the more famous stories about St. Francis today, that's the story of the wolf. It's a touching story, of course. Before I get to that, though, we're in the middle of a book club, and we are studying G.K. Chesterton's Everlasting Man. And Chesterton was comparing different religions, especially the old ancient world pagan religions, polytheism, lots of gods, multiple gods, with the religion, the most important revolution in the history of humanity, namely the fact that Christ started a church, the fact that God became man. And so he was using some of the ancient history, and especially the stories of the Punic Wars, to lay the groundwork and help us understand how monumental the revolution we call Christianity is. Chesterton, obviously living in the modern times, England, of course, he saw action in World War I. His brother died in World War I, and so he lived and wrote a great deal in the years between the two world wars and during World War II and after World War II. Anyway, so he's quite the modern in a lot of sense. He wrote almost 100 years ago, he should be out of date. But he's not. He's not anywhere near out of date. He touches on themes that are eternal because he is trying to share with us the wisdom that comes from Catholicism. Catholicism has a universal appeal, has a timeless, enduring sense of what is right, what is wrong, what is true, what is false. And speaking of which, by the way, today is also important, October 4th, because it's the first day of the Synod on Synodality. We got to keep a close watch and keep an eye on that. Let us pray that some of the possible radical changes that are being hoped for by many take place. All right. So let's see. Anyways, I got to set up. I want to play a little clip from an old movie that you may have seen a while back, because it's an interesting movie about World War II. And being a guy, I often like war movies. It's a story about the fighting in the Pacific Ocean, and especially the story around the raising of the flag that is so iconic. It's the picture upon which the statue of World War II, the Marines raising the flag on Iwo Jima, is made from. If you've ever been to Washington, D.C., there is a very interesting memorial there of World War II, and it's the men raising that flag. So anyways, the movie Flags of Our Fathers is based around that. And so shows the terrible, terrible fighting that went on, the bloodshed, the killing. Just, that's all sick. It's all sad. It was a terrible part of war. War is always terrible. And as many generals have said, it has to be terrible or else we'd like it too much. It's hard. How do we want to say this? It's hard, especially on this feast day of St. Francis, who is the man of peace, right? And our faith is supposed to be the way to peace, the way to live in harmony with everybody. How can we stop wars? That's one of the big questions of life, right? And how can we understand how to stop wars if we don't understand how they start? Anyways, one of Chesterton's points is that people will fight wars primarily for love, and all wars are in some ways religious wars. And we have to know what people love the most and what they hate the most. And every war could be described as a battle between what people love and what others are trying to take from them, that which they love. So they hate those who are trying to take away what they love. And they're motivated. He says that all wars are in some ways religious wars because they deal with what is the ultimate meaning of life and what you ultimately need for life. And take that away and you'll be willing to fight against it. Anyways, I want to start with this, the last scene of the movie, because I think Clint Eastwood was the director, you know, and it was a very powerful movie, and you can't help but feel terrible about for what those soldiers had to go through. But anyways, so the movie ends with the son of the elderly soldier, who's now a grandfather. He fought at Iwo Jima, and now he's dying in a hospital. And the son is visiting his dad. As oftentimes people that fought in World War II didn't talk about the war. That was the same with my father. Well, my father didn't fight too much in World War II, but my father was training to fly Corsairs and when the war ended. So I'm very grateful that he didn't have to fight. Those Corsairs were the airplanes that landed on aircraft carriers. And in those days, a lot of them went in the drink. A lot of people were killed, or at least they crashed, and they'd have to swim out of the cabin of an airplane that missed the runway of the aircraft carrier. Anyways, so this in the movie, the son is coming to visit his father, who's dying in the hospital, and the father says somewhere along the line that, you know, I'm not really a hero, because the son was saying, you're the greatest generation, and you're the generation of heroes, which we often have referred to as the generation that fought World War II. They were, in so many ways, heroes. Unfortunately, I think getting back after the war, they lost some of their sense of heroism. After they got done fighting World War II, they stopped fighting the battle of the domestic battles. It was the generation that really gave us Roe versus Wade, right? The right to abortion snuck in, kind of were on KP duty. They were didn't want to fight another war. And I could so much understand how soldiers coming back, and they saw such terrible, terrible things. And then the issue comes up, oh, should we have the right to abortion? It's not worth fighting over. Nothing's worth fighting over anymore. It's very hard for a man to go through two wars. Some men fight one big war in their life, and that war dominates their sensibilities, their thoughts, and their spirit for most of their life. But it's hard to fight a second war or even a third war. And that's part of what we're facing today, that the war, there is another war, but it's a different kind. We're fighting different enemies. It's a spiritual war. It's a moral war. And it's easy to sit it out, as it were. Anyways, so here's the scene at the end, and it reminds me of something that Chesterton says in his Everlasting Man. So he's going to, I forget what actor plays this part, but the son is talking about his father as he just has passed away. Let's see, it goes like this. Let's see if I can get this here for you. It goes like this.
I finally came to the conclusion that maybe he was right. Maybe there's no such thing as heroes. Maybe there are just people like my dad. I finally came to understand why they were so uncomfortable being called heroes. Heroes are something we create, something we need. It's a way for us to understand what is almost incomprehensible. How people could sacrifice so much for us. But for my dad and these men, the risks they took, the wounds they suffered.
So there it is. It's precious. And I could see why the dad would want to tell his son, it's don't call me a hero. I was just doing my duty. Most soldiers didn't see the big picture. Some did, of course. Some knew what they were fighting against and what they were fighting for. But especially in the era of the draft, you did your duty. And if you can get out of your duty, you'd had a duty to get out of your duty. Right? Because you know how difficult it was. And so, but the thing that reminds me, this little episode in the movie reminds me of a problem that I see in our society today, and that Chesterton saw in his day, and that Chesterton was trying to correct or point out this problem. And so I'm going to use this movie to point out the same thing, because there is a problem with what this son concluded. He says, perhaps there were no heroes. I came to realize, no, he doesn't say perhaps there are no heroes. He says, I came to realize that there were no heroes. There's only people like my dad. And he held his dad in high esteem, of course, but he explains the nature of a hero in terms of our human construct. He says, heroes are something we create because we need them. And for that, he slips into the problem that Chesterton is trying to point out, because Chesterton was pointing out in his book Everlasting Man this great contrast between the civilization of the Carthusians, the and Rome, and so let me back it up here. Carthage, you know, the big city of northern Africa, Carthage. And Chesterton, you know, kind of goes out of his way. Everybody knows these wars, they call them the Punic Wars, were history making. But Chesterton has to try to explain to the modern mind that it really mattered who won. There was a good side and a bad side, even though there was bad ugliness going on in both sides, of course. Romans treated the Carthaginians poorly, as the men of Carthage treated their Roman captives terribly and all the rest. This a little quick lesson. There were three major wars between Rome and Carthage. The first one was a draw. They fought to a draw. The second one, Rome had the advantage over Carthage. And the third, Punic Wars, when Rome really destroyed Carthage. Cato, one of the famous senators of Rome, ended all of his speeches with, Carthage must be destroyed. And Chesterton does a masterful way of explaining why it was good for the human race that Carthage was destroyed. And he relates it to the god, the false god of the Old Testament known as Moloch, because he says Rome particularly hated the culture and the civilization of Carthage because they kept the sacrifice of children, infants, alive. And Moloch, of course, is the god who eats his children. And so clearly Chesterton wants us to root for Rome as we read the stories of the Punic Wars, because that sense of the evil god, the false god, Moloch, the god who maintains the legitimacy, the importance of sacrificing children for your greater good, had to be wiped out, had to be stopped, as it were. As a matter of fact, Chesterton makes a very interesting point about the god of Moloch, who's associated with the other bad, evil god of the Old Testament, Baal. And I remember hearing about Hannibal 1,000 times in my history classes. Hannibal, remember the warrior king or general who pounced on Italy, crossing the Alps with his elephants and all the rest to come and to take Rome, to bring Rome down. And Chesterton wisely points out Hannibal, B-A-L, is a man who also has that evil god spirit in his heart. Baal is the other evil god of the Old Testament. So Moloch and Baal are represented in Carthage and in Hannibal, the barbarians that came to destroy Rome from the north. We could see how the compromising on moral principles, etc., led to the weakness of that civilization. And my friends, we can't help but apply that to our own day and age, how how sad it is that we may be imitating, or we may be entertaining the evil of the Old Testament gods of Moloch and Baal, as it were. I think it's time to take our first break, I think, right here. So I got to come around. I want to make a little more points about Chesterton and how he's explaining what the true spirit of our faith is in Catholicism. So let's take our quick break. I'm Father Tom Coyce, and you are listening to The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Laugh, you make me laugh, you make me laugh, you make me laugh, 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 you make me laugh.
Well, that's the whole point.
You've got to be joking.
No, it's about laughing and joking and having a great time. Join us for a night of laughter at St. Stan's Back to School Comedy Show, Saturday, October 7th. Door opens at 6 p.m., showtime 7 p.m. Admission is just $30 per person with a cash bar, music, and you must be 21 or over.
Are you serious?
Well, of course. The St. Stan's Back to School Comedy Show features the comedy of Jody Baez, Jeannie Dogan, and Alicia Molina. St. Stan's is located at 1255 North Noble. That's two blocks north of Division. On Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. A St. Stan's Back to School Comedy Show, Saturday, October 7th.
I'm Father Tom Coyce, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to The Winds of Change.
All right, pets, pipe down. I've got something to say to you. Yes, that means you too. Please tell your owners that Father Anthony would like to bless all of you on Saturday, October 7th at 9 a.m. at the Outdoor Cross at St. Stanislaus Kostka for the St. Francis of Assisi Blessing of the Animals. Let us thank God for the companionship our animals bring to our lives. St. Stan's is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. The Blessing of the Animals, Saturday, October 7th at 9 a.m. at St. Stanislaus Kostka. And the goldfish are welcome too.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. That little commercial there for the animal blessing does remind us that this is the feast of St. Francis of Assisi. I'm going to get to that story of the wolf. It's a precious story. But I got to continue here with why the ending of that movie, Flags of Our Fathers, disturbs me so much. doesn't disturb me terribly, but it points out something about our modern society and our modern world today that does disturb me quite a bit. And that is we're inculcating, we're believing the masses of people have swallowed what some of the modern philosophers, or the modern anti-Catholic philosophers have called getting beyond good and evil. The moral of the story from that movie is that there are no heroes, but heroes are something we create because we need them, which gives the impression that we can uncreate them, or that we don't. We might be creating the wrong kinds of heroes. In other words, we don't look at the causes of World War II, what causes were in play. You can almost do this with any war. As I said, Chesterton points out the Punic Wars between Rome and Carthage. Could do it about the Civil War, the fighting that went on. It's a common frustration of mine when I watch a war movie that there's not much talked about in terms of why the war is going on. There's a lot of details about what happened. As a matter of fact, there was a wonderful movie about the founder of Opus Dei, Jose Maria Escriva. Many of us know and love that great modern saint. The movie about his life really revolved a lot around the Spanish Civil War. What was the name of that one? It was called There Be Dragons, I think, something like that. Anyways, you watched the whole thing and you saw the difficulty of not only Father Escrivá, but many of the other Catholics that were being hunted down and what have you. But the movie itself gave little understanding of the causes of the Civil War. It quite possibly could have had a lot to say about what our Blessed Mother said in Fatima with the onset of the war, that if we don't turn away from sin, worse things are going to happen, etc. Anyways, but a lot of times, so Chesterton is raising the idea, and I'm repeating it here with this critique of the closing scene of the Flags of Our Fathers. He's saying we have to uncover what is being loved and what is being hated, and what gods are behind our love or hate, as it were. So here's one thing that if the guy narrating there says heroes are something we create because we need them, and so that we could accept that to a certain extent because, okay, we're going to write history. The old saying goes, history is written by the victors, right? And so they're going to make the right heroes out of the right people and make villains out of the bad people. And of course, today you say something like that and somebody who's been to college or been educated in our modern times will almost immediately say, yeah, but if you were a Japanese person and you were studying World War II, you would call different people heroes and different people enemies. So the conclusion, even though that's true, Japanese people will call different people heroes and different people enemies, just like in the American Civil War. The people in the South, we still raise General Robert E. Lee as the great hero. People in the North consider Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant and so many others heroes. So we know that from, shall we say, the subjective side, people will declare different people heroes and villains. But Chesterton is saying, okay, that's a true fact, but that doesn't change the fact that there is a good and evil. Some things are worth fighting for, some things are not worth fighting for, some things are worth dying, shall we say. So if that little line in the movie, heroes are something we create because we need them. You could say the same thing about houses, right? Houses are things we create because we need them. Or how about automobiles are something we create because we need them? You could almost say that about any human fabrication. Human needs are met by inventions of many kinds. But here's where I got to shift to the beauty and the wisdom of St. Francis, because you can't, as much as you could say houses are created by us because we need them, but good and evil are not created by us because we need a sense of good and evil. They are above us or beyond us. They are real. Good is good, whether we think they are good or not. Chesterton is waging the same war that Pope Benedict did when he talked about the tyranny of relativism. He's fighting the same war that John Paul II was fighting when he wrote that powerful, beautiful encyclical called Veritatis Splendor, the splendor of the truth. You know, and that, unfortunately, whatever comes out of the synod on synodality, my friends, it absolutely must be compared to and analyzed in light of what those two previous giants of popes gave us, John Paul II and Benedict XVI. If there are contradictions, then those contradictions have to be pointed out. They have to be analyzed. They have to be opposed if there are. That's why we really have to pray first in Thanksgiving, and then also in hopeful for new and better understandings from those the cardinals that resubmitted their dubia. There were a number of cardinals that wrote a letter to Rome to the Pope to ask him to clarify some things. The way that some of the statements were written were a bit ambiguous, and so Cardinal Burke and others were trying to clarify that ambiguity, and so we have to watch out that contradictions will come alive again. Certainly, they are alive as well. Okay, before I get to St. Francis, wonderful story of the wolf. I got in reading Chesterton's Everlasting Man, and his explanation of how should I say, he makes a distinction between, shall we say, pleasant paganism and vicious paganism. By that he means, or I'm paraphrasing him, pleasant paganism was the pleasant gods of the family, of the household, that you'd have an idol for the god of rain because you want rain to fall on your fields. You'd have a god of light because you needed light in the house. You'd have gods of fertility because you wanted a baby. You'd have gods of everything, all sorts of different things. Anything could be turned into a god. And they were pleasant. Chesterton would say they're false gods. They weren't true gods, as we find St. Paul in the New Testament, of course, doing debate with the pagans of the Roman world at that time. But Chesterton points out that there's a different kind of paganism that didn't have playful gods, that were sort of harmless, but that there was a turning toward evil gods, demonic. And this is where it could even have true power to it, to their supplications, as it were. So the idea that if you turn toward a god who would get things done, the evil gods, the demonic gods, were turned to because they got things done. And that's a sad, here's what it reminds me of. It reminds me of an argument I had with a young person who I was trying to encourage them to be pro-life in their stance. And this person was going through difficulty in their life. Financially, they were broke. Didn't seem like there was much going their way. And this person kind of, I don't know, proudly or defiantly said, I don't care about voting for whether a politician is pro-life or pro-choice. I want my politicians to make the economy better so that I could pay my bills and that I could get along in life. And it eerily reminded me of this kind of attitude of, I will call upon the assistance of the evil gods because they get things done. It's kind of like even somebody who calls themselves a pro-life person will accept the fact that I got to vote for a pro-choice person because that's the price I'm willing to pay for a better benefit, a benefit that's economic or a benefit that's, I don't know, psychological, I suppose, but primarily the economic benefit because poverty is the worst of evils and the good, luxurious life is the best of goods. And so Chesterton would not like that kind of assessment. And so so anyways, that playing with or that toying with or that calling on the assistance of Moloch or Baal is a bit like the modern world today that's saying we've got to keep the pro-choice option alive. We know that it's a bad thing. That's one of the points Chesterton was making. The ancients who called upon the power of the evil demonic gods like Moloch, they knew it was bad. They knew it was wicked. It was terrible. But it's the price you're willing to pay for another benefit. And it just echoes down through the ages, doesn't it? And here we see a similar similar situation. How it reminds me of something Saint Therese of Lisieux, whose feast we just had. She said, "I can't understand why people don't throw their lives into the hands of so an affectionate God, as God is for us, as Jesus is for us." She can't understand how they would turn away from the most affectionate, good, loving God. Well, I could explain to Saint Teresa, here's why or how, is because you're willing to call on the assistance of another God, a false God, or a wicked God. You know it's kind of like why do people keep voting for the same kind of corrupt politicians? Because those are the ones who get the job done, and as long as they're helping you survive, you don't care if they cheat or steal or rob. It's kind of like if you're having problems on the playground as a child, and you're being bullied or your life is made miserable, you're gonna appreciate a bigger bully to be on your side. And you don't care if the bigger bully lies, cheats, or beats up the other guy, as long as they're protecting you and protecting your interests. You see what I'm saying? It's a sad state of affairs, but has to be seen, has to be appreciated. Anyways, okay, I think we're a little late for our bottom of the hour break. So let's take our another break, and we got to get to St. Francis of Assisi, right? Today's wonderful feast. I'm Father Tom Coyes, and you are listening to The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Laugh, you make me laugh, you make me laugh, you make me laugh, 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 you make me laugh.
Well, that's the whole point.
You've got to be joking.
No, it's about laughing and joking and having a great time. Join us for a night of laughter at St. Stan's Back to School Comedy Show, Saturday, October 7th. Door opens at 6 p.m., showtime 7 p.m. Admission is just $30 per person with a cash bar, music, and you must be 21 or over.
Are you serious?
Well, of course. The St. Stan's Back to School Comedy Show features the comedy of Jody Baez, Jeannie Dogan, and Alicia Molina. St. Stan's is located at 1255 North Noble. That's two blocks north of Division. On Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. A St. Stan's Back to School Comedy Show, Saturday, October 7th.
We are the students of St. Stan's Lacosta Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. Visit ststanschicago.org to find out how.
And you're listening to The Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststanschicago.org. ststanschicago.org.
Hey, welcome back. I think that's my signal to start talking again. Good to be with you here. And remember, friends, you can listen, of course, to The Winds of Change live on 7:50 a.m., but probably for a lot of us busy people, listening on a podcast is the way to go. Make sure you know where Podbean is. That's the app or the company that would have our show on, and you could look for Winds of Change Show. You can put in Father Anthony Bush, Winds of Change Show, Chicago, all those things should bring up our shows. And to get Brain Wrinkling Wednesdays with me, Father Coys, you just have to look for the Wednesday dates, as it were. So God bless you. These are meditations. These are ways to keep our brain wrinkled and brain turning toward the great wisdom that is found in and only in Catholicism, right? Okay, so here's the story of the wolf and Saint Francis. I'm taking this from a website here, The Taming of the Wolf, and it's known as a legend. We could probably say it didn't exactly happen. But it captures the spirit of Francis's ability to negotiate and bring peace between warring people, right? So here it goes like this. There was a town in Italy called Gubbio, a prosperous village that had a great problem. A wolf was eating their livestock and attacking the people. Nothing the townspeople did protect them from the wolf. Never had they seen such a fierce predator. He killed a shepherd, and then the shepherd's brother and father, when they went out to deal with this menace. The next morning, the town was abuzz with the story told by the shepherd's mother and sisters. The mayor of Gubbio announced he would send 3 of his best guards to find and slay the wolf that very afternoon. At dusk, the townspeople could hear shouts and clashing of metal from the woods. Then it was quiet. The guards had met the wolf. Late in the night, the only survivor of the encounter struggled into the anxious town and collapsed. After he was revived, he told his tale of their fight with the fierce and powerful wolf. As the story rushed through the town, the wolf grew larger and more ferocious. Fear was in the eyes of everyone in Gubbio. Children were kept close by, weapons at the ready, and the defenses of the town raised. The mayor consulted with his advisors and decided to see if St. Francis of Assisi could help them. They had heard that he could talk to animals and that God talked to him. Several brave messengers were sent to find Francis and ask him for his help. They had the good fortune to find him in Assisi at the house of Bernardo, his first follower. They told him of the tragic attacks of the wolf and how frightened people were, almost in the stage of a siege. They thought Francis was the only one who would be able to help them. They begged the simple holy man to help and implored him to come to them right away. Francis was moved by their plight and wanted to do what he could. He said they could leave in the morning and they should eat and rest with his brothers that night. After dinner, they prayed with Francis for a solution and slept that night with hope in their hearts. Dawn found them walking down the hill from Assisi on their way to Gubbio. In time, they arrived at the woods near the town. The messengers pointed to where the wolf had slain the two guards, not far from the road. They stayed in a tighter group as they hurried the rest of the way, watching for the wolf. The gate to the town was open, and they arrived and was quickly closed behind them. The entire town followed Francis to the town square where the mayor eagerly met them. They went into the town hall to eat and discuss what Francis would do with the wolf. The mayor wondered what Francis could do with such a challenge. The mayor hated that wolf. He knew the men who were killed and their families. One of the guards was a cousin to the mayor's wife. If he were younger, he himself would have led the guards after the wolf. He wanted Francis to strike that wolf dead or send him to the town of Spoleto, their old enemy. Either would satisfy a need for revenge and stop the attacks. Francis listened as the mayor described what had happened to their peaceful town. He had much empathy for the families of the victims and wanted to meet the wolf and hear his story too. Francis stated that the next morning he would go to the woods where the guards had been killed to see if he could find the wolf. That night he prayed for the wisdom to find a solution that would benefit everyone. Early the next morning, refreshed and confident this would work out, Francis was accompanied by the townspeople to the gates of Gubbio. They wished him well and retreated to their homes, worried that Francis would soon share the fate of the shepherds and the guards. He walked on to the woods, ready to engage the wolf. As he neared the first stand of trees, the wolf appeared and began to stalk Francis. His slow, deliberate steps, the walk of a predator, announced the wolf's intention. He drew near and near, closing in a circle around the holy man of Assisi. Seeing the wolf, Francis felt a connection. He made the sign of the cross and called the wolf to meet him in peace under the grace of the Lord. The wolf watched as Francis came closer. "Come, brother wolf, I will not hurt you. Let us talk in peace." The wolf froze in mid-step. The wolf struggled with doubt and uncertainty. Finally, understanding that Francis meant him no harm, the wolf walked to Francis and sat back on his haunches, ready to listen. Francis told the wolf that he had come from Gubbio and described what the townspeople were experiencing because of the wolf's actions. He described the pain and resentment they held toward the wolf. "How did this come to happen?" Francis asked the wolf. "Why did you kill the livestock and the people?" The wolf told Francis his story. He had been left behind by his pack because he was injured and couldn't keep up. He could only catch prey that didn't run fast, like sheep and goats. He really preferred to eat deer and rabbits, but
with his injured leg, that was out of the question. He explained to Francis that all he wanted was to eat when he was hungry.
Francis implored him to explain his actions. The wolf continued, the first shepherd he had killed. The shepherd was trying to protect his own flock, and the wolf had no choice but to fight back when the shepherd attacked him. That afternoon, two more men came after him, and instinct took over me. I quickly killed them, leaving their bodies where they fell. The next day, the three guards came hunting me. I was only defending myself when I fought them. I killed two of them. As the third man was no longer a threat, I let him go. Francis could see that the wolf was only acting to fulfill his needs. He had made unfortunate choices that affected people of whom he knew nothing. Through Francis, the wolf was able to feel the pain of the people in Gubbio, and the wolf felt remorse. He was sorry for the pain he had caused, but he needed to eat. What else could he do? Hours passed as Francis prayed. The wolf watched closely, not fully understanding what was taking place, but sensing that Francis believed he felt remorse at having caused such pain. When Francis emerged from his prayerful contemplation, he quietly suggested an answer to the wolf. It was a suggestion that could meet the needs of both the town and the wolf. Francis proposed to the wolf that the townspeople could feed him, and in return, the wolf would stop killing the people and their livestock. The wolf thought this would work well for him, but worried the people would still want to kill him. Francis understood the wolf's concern and assured him he would present the idea to the townspeople in such a way that he would be forgiven and welcomed into the town. He knew they could let go of their fear and hated if they saw the wolf and let go of their fear and hate if they saw the wolf ask for forgiveness and accede to a peaceful relationship. Francis extended his hand. The wolf showed agreement by placing his paw in Francis's hand. St. Francis and the wolf walked back to Gubbio. As they neared the gate, the citizens could not believe their eyes. Francis and the wolf continued to the town square, although the mayor and the entire town watched with hate and fear. The wolf had to keep his eyes on Francis to still his fear. Francis called out, "Come, countrymen, the wolf will not hurt you. Let us talk in peace. I have spoken with the wolf, and he apologizes for his actions and wants to make amends." Francis told them the wolf's story. "He has the same needs as you and only wants to eat and not go hungry. Can the people of Gubbio feed him if he promises to never again take the lives of the people and their animals? Remember, our Savior taught forgiveness. He taught us to love our enemies." The citizens returned skeptical stares. Francis continued, "This will be your wolf. He can't be killed or passed off to Spoleto or Perugia, for that matter. He will serve the town as a defender as long as he lives." The citizens of Gubbio asked Francis to talk privately with them to help them understand his suggestion. The mayor guaranteed no one would hurt the wolf while they conferred. The people of Gubbio talked with each other for hours. Relatives of the dead were the hardest to convince. They harbored a hard place in their hearts for the wolf. Francis wept with them and touched them in a way that softened their hearts. Finally, after many tears, they found compassion for the wolf. At Francis's suggestion, they addressed him as Brother Wolf. Francis asked the mayor and Brother Wolf to declare a pact. The people would be safe from the wolf would be safe from them. Everyone expressed joy that the shadow of fear had been lifted from their town. The wife of the shepherd, the man who was the first to fall, brought out food to feed Brother Wolf. She was crying in relief to have the burden of hatred lifted from her spirit. Brother Wolf was humbled when he found his apology accepted.
More food was brought out, and soon everyone was eating together. Word spread to other towns. Soon the people of Gubbio were proclaiming proudly that they had a special wolf, Brother Wolf. He lived another 2 years like that until he died, cared for by the generous and forgiving town of Gubbio. Precious, no? Well, we're almost at the end, perhaps we'll go out with we skipped our third break. Let's get in our third round of our commercials as they are. And with that, I'll bid you a wonderful adieu. God bless you. And remember to keep your heart open to the truth, and beware of the errors of heresy and the problems that our modern world sets for us. Let's follow the path of the saints and embrace the truth that really flows really only from Catholicism. I'm Father Tom Coyes. Let's take our break. You're listening to The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
All right, pets, pipe down. I've got something to say to you. Yes, that means you too. Please tell your owners that Father Anthony would like to bless all of you on Saturday, October 7th at 9 a.m. at the Outdoor Cross at St. Stanislaus Kostka for the St. Francis of Assisi Blessing of the Animals. Let us thank God for the companionship our animals bring to our lives. St. Stan's is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. The Blessing of the Animals, Saturday, October 7th at 9 a.m. at St. Stanislaus Kostka. And the goldfish are welcome too.
I'm Father Tom Coyes, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to The Winds of Change.
Here is an update on the Fulton Sheen petition.
We Catholics stand just inches from the goal line to have the saint we desperately need now, Venerable Fulton Sheen, publicly declared blessed. Yet new obstacles keep arising to delay this from happening. The Diocese of Peoria is now requiring the unanimous support of the U.S. bishops behind the beatification of Fulton Sheen before a new date is set for the ceremonial mass. This has never been necessary in the Church's history. The Fulton Sheen Movement's petition drive to set a new date soon for Sheen's beatification mass now has 10,000 Catholics from around the world clamoring for this. We need this voice magnified by hundreds of thousands more Catholics. And you can help us do that. Take action. Go to FultonSheenMovement.com and sign the petition and share it everywhere, because everyone agrees we need Blessed Fulton Sheen now more than ever.
Bye now, and God love you.
Inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time.